Hi, I'm Jason Nichols, and I'm on the left.
And I'm Vince Colonnaise, and I'm on the right.
And if we can't find common ground in this world today, then we're all just travelers.
Passing each other in an international airport.
In this great American experiment,
we'll be relegated to the trash bin of history.
So let's come together
to debate without yelling, and let's save this nation.
We saw some really important elections all over the country, and we're here to talk to another special candidate coming up next on Vince and Jason Save the Nation. Vince and Jason Save the Nation is brought to you by GoldCo.
Welcome back to another edition of Vince and Jason Save the Nation. I'm Vince Colonnaise alongside my friend Jason Nichols. Jason, who are we speaking with today?
Today we have a very special guest, someone who is a mother, a registered nurse, and now a candidate for Congress in the 4th District of Arizona. We have Delina DeSanto. Ms. DeSanto, how are you doing today?
Great. I'm doing great. Having a good day and excited to speak with you guys.
So I wanted to ask you, you know, you were a nurse, you've got a family. What motivated you to want to run for Congress?
I live in Congressional District 4, and I realized that Paul Gosar was not doing the job that a U.S. representative should do. And I decided that there are a lot of struggling families in Congressional District 4 and around Arizona in our country. He wasn't working on healthcare. He was wanting to defund public education. Our water issues. I mean, there's so many issues. And I decided someone has to have a voice for Congressional District 4. So I said, I am.
Delina, what are those issues? If you could drill down, kind of describe for us what the population is like in District 4 in Arizona, and where you think people need help.
Well, healthcare, being a nurse, I can see that a lot of them are struggling. They don't have health insurance. It's very expensive, even through ACA. And also public education funding. I mean, we're one of the lowest in paid salaries for teachers, and our public school funding for schools itself, for capital, has decreased tremendously. Mm-hmm. And so they need to have that kind of safety net for their kids and for America. We need to have those children growing up educated. And then also our water issues are one of the biggest things here, as you probably see, you know, just not on local TV, but across the nation, you probably saw Lake Mead. And so we need to make sure that we have policies in place that are going to protect the people here in Arizona so that we have water for the future.
What are the industries that people work in District 4?
In District 4 is healthcare. Mm-hmm. Transportation, for the state, and then also technology. We have a lot of technology in the area, but mm-hmm. then we also have a lot of small businesses, like along the Colorado River area. We have, you know, kayaking businesses and boating industries and stuff like that. And that's the other thing about small businesses. They need to have those protections in place too. They need to make sure that we need them for the economy. So,
yeah, this is a mass. I'm just looking at a map of this. It is a massive district. District 4 covers some of central Arizona and almost entirely all of western Arizona. So I imagine you have a pretty diverse array of concerns and needs among the voters who live in that district.
Right. Farming is another one. Agriculture. Mm-hmm. Is another one too. So yeah,
amazing.
So go ahead,
Jason.
So I was going to ask, how does someone? And this may be a loaded question because I think everyone knows where I stand politically. But how does someone like Paul Gosar get elected by a district that has hardworking families who need health care? Someone, Paul Gosar, who's been rejected by his own family. How does someone like that come to represent the hardworking people of District 4?
To be honest, it's because we have a very conservative district. It was outlined, redistricted in 2012 that way. But also it's, I think the failure too of the state, Democratic Party in regards to getting out the vote, registering voters, and they have tried much better. They are doing much better since 2020 with Mission for Arizona, trying to get out there and register. We have a lot of Democrats and independents in this district, but a lot of them don't vote, or a lot of them are not even registered. And so that's what I think we've had a, you know, they always say it's a red district, but it's also the messaging. I don't think that we have had a strong enough Democrat out there to be able to tell them that they understand the struggles they're going through. And that's why, again, that's why I wanted to run, to let them know that it takes a lot of money and it takes a lot of, you know, mass mailings and stuff like that, you know, to be able to reach them. But they're not being reached in that way. They're not being told that there is somebody else out there that will work for them instead of doing the things that Paul Gosar is doing, the insane things he's doing.
I wonder if I can connect all of this to the election results we started seeing come in across the country yesterday, and if you have thoughts about that, and in particular about Democrats broadly, their ability to connect with voters on an individual basis and to convince them that they will actually serve their needs. What do you think, as you saw these election results come in from places like Virginia, New Jersey, which is, as we talk, still up in the air, the New York mayor's race and Minneapolis, where they voted on whether or not they wanted to get rid of the police department and replace it with a public safety department. What did you kind of think about all of these results? And is there anything that connects all of them?
Well, I think, you know, looking at the Virginia and New Jersey race, a lot of there was probably over 1 million or 2 million people that didn't vote in this election. And so to me, that was a failure on probably both parties in getting people out to vote. But then also, I think that we're not reaching the Black and Latino communities. We're not letting them know that we're here and listening to them. And I think if it's going to be interesting when they go to look at the results and who didn't vote and, mm-hmm. and what groups of people did not vote, I think it's going to be very interesting to find out who they were. And I really believe it's going to be the communities that feel that they're not being listened to. I mean, especially with, you know, Biden's agenda not getting pushed through. I think they're feeling like, well, is there anything ever going to get done? You know, why should I vote? My voice isn't being heard. And so, again, I think we're failing in our message as Democrats to be able to get out there and tell everyone, yes, we are going to do this. But then also we're failing in Congress by not passing the bills that are out there important to them.
There's going to be obviously a big debate today. We're already seeing it transpire, Delina, between Democrats in Congress over whether or not what you just said is the proper course forward. In other words, some Democrats, many of them are part of, say, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, are of the idea right now that the failure to pass these two big spending packages by Democrats is the reason that Terry McAuliffe and others suffered consequences yesterday. But there are others considered more moderate Democrats, somebody like Virginia's Abigail Spanberger, of course, immediately leaps to mind, who seem to be of the impression that actually, no, it's the pursuit of those gigantic spending packages that ended up wounding Democrats electorally. Where do you fall on that?
I don't think that's the case. I just think that it's more of we're not getting Manchin and Sinema on board to be able to pass these bills. Mm-hmm. I know right now it will pass in the House. I know for a fact it will. But I really
both
think
packages. That, you think?
I think so. And I do understand the fact of the cost of it. I mean, you know, I'm with Sinema, Manchin, and others about the cost of it. However, we have had so many economists say that it can be paid for over the 10-year period that is being discussed within those bills. Now, granted, if we don't want to go for the $3.5 trillion and we want to only go for the $2 trillion, then let's get it done. you know, right. or even the 1.5 trillion, because I think that is really what's hurting us, is because if we don't pass those bills, we are telling people that are saying, hey, I need those jobs. I need those infrastructure jobs. I need those. We need the water protection. We need all these things. But we're not being listened to. We can't get anything passed. Why should I vote? And so I think that's what's telling people not to go out and vote, because they're not being listened to. And I think we need, even if it's 1.5 or 1.3 trillion, if we pass it, we're going to have people on our side. We're going to have Americans on our side, and they're going to say, hey, wait, they are listening to me. Even if we have to get a little bit at a time, because you know what, if we passed the 1.5 trillion last week, I think, the Democrats would have done better in the elections yesterday, because it would have shown, hey, look, at least they're getting something done. I bet you they'll get something done next year. You know, we can do more as we go along. But if we keep fighting with the bigger number, I think what's going to happen is we're going to lose everybody.
So what is it? Does your campaign have any relationship with Senator Sinema? And my other question is, how are the national Democratic Party, are they assisting you or any candidates that you know? Because I think you've made a good point about their failures in terms of messaging, their failures in terms of reaching out in districts that may seem like a long shot. Right. But I'm wondering if they're actually trying to invest in you and invest in candidates like you.
No, they're not. I wish I had the National Party on my side, like they did with Hero, to Pernini, in 2020. But no, not yet. I mean, you know, we're trying to talk with them and discuss, you know, what it is that we're trying to do. I know they have a lot on their plate, especially with this coming 2022 election. However, if they don't get behind strong candidates and especially with, people like Paul Gosar, and if we continue to have those type of people in Congress, it's going to get worse. And the divide's going to get worse, and the divide among Americans are going to get worse, not just in Congress. So yes, I'm in discussions. My campaign manager is in discussions with them. I hope they do get behind my race. The Arizona State Party, is behind my race, Mission for Arizona. So we'll see what happens, you know. But again, as we all know, it takes a lot of money, and everybody's asking for money right now already, and we still have a year out. So it'll be interesting. But I fight every single day, so we'll see what happens.
Well, I think Arizona is incredibly important. You know, there are a lot of states where races are going to be tighter. They're going to be really important. But I think for you, and for a couple other candidates in those really important swing states, I think, you know, the party needs to get behind you. So I'm just going to say that publicly. Hopefully people are listening.
Well, I think the message is going to have to get strong for all of it, right? So if you're going to get behind Greg Stanton and Raul Grijalva and Ruben Gallego and whoever takes over Ann Kirkpatrick's, right? Because you got that seat going to be open. You know, Tom O'Halloran, right? So his district may become bigger. So I think what should happen is that the party should get behind all of us and say that this is what our message is, because I think our message is all basically the same. And so to really push all of us out there, so it shows that we are a party together. That, you know, we're not just pushing off me, say, for instance, oh, well, because that's a red district, you know, let's not, you know, support Delina, but hey, let's get behind Tom O'Halloran and whoever else, right? So I think it has to be a group thing to show the message, and then to be able to bring the message from each individual on, especially commercials, because again, you got to remember, in rural districts, they don't go on social media. I may have 100,000 followers, but that doesn't mean that's 100,000 voters in my district. Right. That all that means is that I have a lot of support. And so I need to reach the rural areas by commercials and mass mailings. So, you know, people say, oh, wow, you can reach them through social media. No, because a lot of people are not on Facebook, and a lot of people are definitely not on Twitter in regards to my voters.
So what are the age demographics? Is yours an older district, or is it mainly younger people?
It's I would say it's an older district because it's more rural. However, we are having more and more people move into the district because it is a little more affordable than Maricopa area. Now, I mean, the housing market here is just growing like crazy. So people are moving out further and further out into the rural areas. So I think the demographics are changing, and that should be a plus for us. And those are the ones who we have to reach out to.
Kind of fascinating, you know, to the considerations here. You mentioned a moment ago that you think the Democrats are mostly, and maybe I don't want to get you wrong here, but the Democrats are mostly on the same page. So as a result, that everybody should be supported. But don't you think there are divisions within the Democratic Party about the direction of the party? We've seen, you know, yesterday, just in the wake of the results, concerns from people like, you know, James Carville, of course, longtime Democrat strategist and others, that Democrats are losing touch with working class Americans and are not as concerned as they should be about their needs. And I would imagine that there must be some real divisions within the party over that issue.
Well, and that's what I was saying earlier, okay? The Black communities, the Latino communities, those are the working class people that we should be reaching to. Mm-hmm. Because if you're gonna lose by 1,000 votes, then did you reach out to those communities? Because right. Those communities would have been able to have those, make up those votes, right? So that's, again, that's why I'm interested in finding out who didn't vote in New Jersey and Virginia, right? Because that's the working class, middle class people that we have to reach, especially the working class. We have people here that are struggling. They're working each and every day, but they're not getting ahead. Now, granted, Arizona has a $13 minimum wage, which is nice, an hour. However, that still doesn't work for people. They're not getting enough. And so some of them can't work even full-time jobs. And so they're working two or three jobs. Those are the people that we have to reach. Those are the people that we need to work for also so that they get out and vote. But yes, the messaging, getting back to the messaging, it's not getting to those people that I feel that it should be. Sometimes, I'll probably get in trouble for this. Sometimes what happens is we go out and we want to be comfortable. The people in both parties, they want to just be with their own, the Democrats, talk to them. They're familiar. They'll go to the groups, they'll go to the clubs. And so they'll talk to them, but they're not reaching out to other working class. They're not saying, hey, I'm going to have a meeting in this building at this time. Come and talk to me, right? They don't have these town hall meetings like they used to years ago. Now it's all just, oh, let me go to the club. Oh, let me go to, you know, the county chair, or let me do this. And it's only those Democrats that they're reaching. And then they say, oh, well, go out to your communities and talk to everybody. People don't. They don't have that a lot of people don't. There's not a lot of activists that, you know, here in Arizona that just go out to every single house. And so that's what we need to do, is we need to reach them somehow, some way. And that's why we need a better messaging to be able to reach them.
Yeah.
So I actually expected Vince to ask this question, but I'm going to ask it. You're in Arizona, which is a border state. Uh-huh. So I wanted to ask you how you would grade this administration on their handling of the border, and what you would ask for, you know, if you were elected, from the Biden administration and from Congress in order to deal with what's going on the border.
The bottom line is we need immigration reform. There's both parties are not working on this at all. When I was working for U.S. Senator Ben Nighthorst Campbell as a Senate aide, John McCain and Ted Kennedy were working on an immigration reform bill. And it was a great bill. And it should have passed in 2004. And then when it tried again, I think 2005, and I think again in 2007. And it didn't pass. And both parties complain, oh, you know, the Republicans don't want to work on an immigration reform bill. Oh, the Democrats don't want to work on an immigration reform bill. We need to have an immigration reform bill because our Border Patrol is overwhelmed. We don't have enough judges and processors at the border to process the people that are coming over on the border. Now, we can blame Trump and we can, you know, people can blame Biden. That's fine. But we still have a broken system. And we do need to have the workers come over because we have, like I was saying, we have farm areas. We need those workers to come over. But a lot of them want to go back home, but they don't want to get caught. And so we need to have a process system in place to get them. The Dreamers, we need to make sure they become citizens of the United States. But we're not working on that. We'd rather complain about it. The Republicans rather complain about it. Paul Gosar wanted to have them arrested, you know, during the presidential speaking engagement, whatever it was at the Capitol. It's insane that we're not working on something that would help the Border Patrol. We are putting them in a situation where they're almost angry, a lot of them, because they get overwhelmed at the border. And then, you know, people make, you know, get mad at the guy on the horse. Of course, you're going to have a couple of jerks, right? You're the guy on the horse that was whipping some of the Haitians when they were crossing the river, and he wasn't whipping them, but it was like he was corralling them, you know? And the thing is I don't think they just know what to do. Right? They get so overwhelmed. If you see thousands of people on the other side of the river and they're starting to come across and there's only say 20 Border Patrol people, what can they do? Right? So we need to give them the resources that they need and the policies. And that's the problem, is we have no strong policies in place for them to take control of the situation. And we are having a lot of people coming over. We have many, many countries and refugees and asylum seekers trying to come over. But if we had a strong immigration reform bill in place, then we'd have the policies that would have to be followed. And these policies now that we have are very weak. And so that's why we need a new and we need a strong immigration reform policy.
I agree with you that we need to resolve a bunch of existing problems with our immigration system through new legislation. But there is a bunch of existing legislation and statutes and policies that the Biden administration is either dispensed with or is ignoring, and it's created a massive magnet for these waves of migration. A lot of people have, of course, been claiming asylum. A range of them, as this is adjudicated, will or will not receive asylum. And all of them who cross the border and then claim asylum, they are both simultaneously claiming asylum and illegal immigrants if they do it through that border crossing. And the reality is that the Biden administration, for instance, like stopped construction of the wall. They didn't have to, but a lot of those pieces are now rotting and a lot of lost money in that could have continued to serve as a deterrent. They're fighting against Remain in Mexico. At least at the moment, the courts are trying to keep DHS keeping people in Mexico. You've got Alejandro Mayorkas, the DHS secretary, who's decided that ICE will no longer consider illegal immigration alone a basis for deportation. There will be no more worksite raids that lead to deportations. All of the signals, I mean, look, you could disagree with each of those things individually. You could say, look, we shouldn't be really in the business of deporting people if their only crime is their illegal entry to the United States. I can understand those positions, but you have to admit they're creating a massive magnet for the types of migration that's coming into the United States right now. Each person that comes across the border, you put a microphone in front of them, as many reporters have, what's bringing you here that wasn't bringing you before? The answer is one name. It's Joe Biden. Uh-huh. And so I understand the point you're making, Delaney, that like, hey, we can handle border security. We can handle an amnesty for Dreamers. We can do all these things in concert. But there are a bunch of laws on the books right now that are just really being ignored because of the policy preferences of the current administration.
And these policies have been ignored for many, many years. It's not just the Biden administration, it was the Trump administration. And then he took it a little too far. So again, what we need to do is we need to have a better immigration reform policies or policy so that they can know what to do. If talking about the wall, I'll tell you right now, I live here in Arizona and everyone, you know, I love when I talk to people, friends, relatives, you know, back east, and they'll say, well, how come the wall's not done? How come they didn't finish the wall? we were spending billions of dollars on a wall that they climb over. There's parts of the wall that they can get the kids and young kids through in between the metal parts that come down. They can get a damn truck with a ladder and climb over the wall. They could throw one of those rope ladders over on right. the other side and climb down. I mean, having a wall is insane. It really is. It's insane because that's not going to stop people from coming here if they want to come here.
But we need it. Yeah, I just had one thing, and I don't know how your positions have changed through the years. I've just met you, so this may be the position you've always had. But that wasn't always the case. Democrats, for a very long time, have been in favor of border barriers to varying extents. They've been in favor of walls. They've routinely voted for them. It really changed in earnest when Donald Trump ran on that issue, build the wall. That's when you started to see massive partisan divides on whether or not physical structures serving as barriers on the border are good. I think you're basically right. Obviously, you are right. There are other better ways, I think, by and large, to enforce border security. Among them is to make it really clear that you can't just enter the country illegally, and there should be consequences for that. But right.
I believe in the consequences. I mean, I don't believe in throwing them in cages and separating families and doing all that inhumane stuff that Trump did. However, I do believe that we have to have consequences. There has to be a process that they can come through. And it's going to get worse. This is what I'm more concerned about. We're going to have a worse crisis at our border with climate change. We're going to have more people running out of water, poverty, the fields drying up. If you look around the world and you see what's going on, we are going to have a worse crisis at our border, and it's already starting in other countries. And it's not just because of authoritarianism with their leaders, it's also because of climate change. And if we don't do something now, it's going to get worse. So yes, we have to have a process where if somebody tries to come over illegally, we need to make sure that they are getting processed. So, and that's what the thing is they have, either way, we can't just pick them up, bring them back to the border. We should process them so we get their names, we get who they are and their families. And if they're coming for asylum, then yes, let's have the processors do that and enough judges to process them. But we need to have something in place. And I'm not saying I have all the answers. I don't right. think any of us have all the answers.
Right.
But we all need to sit down and we need to take, to me, I would take the John McCain, Ted Kennedy bill and I would say, okay, what do they have in it? And how does it work for today and tomorrow in the future? And be able to make a good immigration reform bill that so that when somebody comes to the border, we already have a process. We have steps to take and mm-hmm. we can tell them this is exactly what's going to go on because Mexico is going to continue letting people in because there, if you look at their border side, it's there. There's crime going on all the time. They want them to come into the United States because there's so much crime going on and sex trafficking, human trafficking, so many things that they don't want to deal with it. So they'll let people come over. And so these other countries are just saying, all right, go ahead, go, you know, Guatemala, come on, Mexico, come on, you know, get over to the United States. We can't allow that to continue to happen because then we're spending billions and billions of dollars for all of that when we should have a policy in place and be able to give the resources to the Border Patrol. They also don't make a lot of money, right?
Right.
They don't, what is it, $40,000? Some of them don't even live with their families because they don't want their families living near the border or at the border. So, I mean, there's so many things that we could do to help them also for their with those billions of dollars so that they enjoy their job and that they're getting paid enough and that they're having the resources that they need. And some of them don't live in homes with full air conditioning. I mean, there's a lot of things that go on at the border that a lot of people don't know.
Right.
And we need to make sure that they have those resources and we have good people working there. Sorry, I get emotional.
No, it's good. It's a good answer. Jason, go ahead. You had other questions?
Yeah, so I want to kind of follow up on that. You spoke a little bit about climate change and some of the things that are happening, particularly in Central America, that are actually driving this. They've had mudslides and other extreme weather events. What should we do about climate change? And does climate change actually affect some of the farmers in your district?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, yes. I mean, our water is being depleted. And one of the biggest things, you know, I want to bring up here is foreign entities, foreign countries that have bought farms here in agriculture. So like in Kingman, La Paz County, what they do is they'll grow alfalfa. Now, alfalfa is a water absorbing plant. And so what happens is that they'll drill more wells on their property so that they go deeper and deeper and deeper for water to grow this alfalfa. But then what they're doing is they're transporting that alfalfa out of the country to Saudi Arabia, to wherever over there. So what's happening then is that these wells are getting deeper and deeper. But then the people, the working class people who live out there that are on wells, don't have water. They're bringing up mud and silt. And so now they have to dig deeper. Well, how the heck are they going to be able to afford to drill at $5,000 a foot or whatever it may be down? And if they're gone, if these farmers are going down, say, 5,000 feet, and they're already, the working class person is at say 500 feet, how the heck are they going to afford to drill deeper and deeper themselves? They can't afford to have a driller come in and drill deeper. So we're already affecting the working class. But then on the farms, they are working hard to try to conserve their water in different ways. I mean, they are trying to find ways. They're also trying to find plants that don't need as much water anymore as what we used to, like cotton was the big thing, you know. And Yuma is one of the biggest things in regards to our produce. And so they're trying to find ways to conserve their water. They're working hard at it. But again, here we are, if you have all this growth going on in Maricopa County, people come and move here and they want the trees that are not from here. They want grass, and they want all these things that are water absorbing. And so, cause they want their yard to be pretty now that they live in a desert. And so we're having those problems with developments. And so we got to come up with a very strong conservation of our water, because if you look at Lake Mead and how low it is, and then they've talked about how the Colorado River is not having the amount of water that it's supposed to have coming down. And then you also had the Colorado River Indian tribe giving water to Phoenix for a couple of years, but those water rights will have to go back to the tribe. So here we are, you know, saying it's like, oh, well, if, as long as the faucet turns on and there's water in it, we're fine. Mm-hmm. You know, but that's not, we have to look at the big picture and the future of Arizona. And so we have to learn to conserve and we need to have policies in place for that also.
Delina, how much resentment is there about foreign owned farms in Arizona extracting the resources and then exporting all of the goods out of Arizona?
You're really starting to hear more and more people saying that this has to stop. It's basically what they're doing is transporting our water out of our country, you know, because they're growing alfalfa. So, you know, so then they transport it out. Yeah, there's a lot of people that are starting to say that we may need to, you know, put policies in place to kind of curb them from doing that, because it takes a lot of water. But the thing is that, see, see, if you're in a rural area, Phoenix, the Phoenix area, the metro area, there's control over how much water can come out of a well in the metro area. But once it goes out to the rural area and you own farmland, there is no control of how many wells you put on your property. So that's where the problem lies.
How many American how many American workers are getting jobs out of all of these foreign-owned farms?
Not that many.
Are they bringing in workers from other countries or?
Not that I don't think so. I mean, they probably have their from what somebody told me in La Paz is that they have you know, some people that know what to do, where, how to transport it, how to, you know, grow it, whatever, and then transport it over to Saudi Arabia. But there's really not, I mean, maybe 20 people, you know, there's not a lot of workers that they're bringing in because all they're doing is growing alfalfa and that's it. So they grow it, cut it, pack it, go, and then it goes over to Saudi Arabia. So really they're not supporting our working class.
So Vince, if I could just ask one more question.
Please, go for it.
So there seems to be a lot of times in the Democratic Party, when we're talking about messaging, you mentioned that we need to mention to message to African-Americans and Latinos. And I 100% agree with that. I think sometimes the Democratic Party makes a lot of mistakes by blaming African-Americans when they lose, you know, and not giving them enough credit when they win. But at the same time, there are many who say, like James Carville, that say that we're not messaging enough and try to make a juxtaposition between messaging to urban Latinos, say in Phoenix, and not to working class, white, rural communities, and that we're not doing enough to do that. Do you agree with that? And if so, what is the message that we should be sending so that they don't fall prey to the culture war stuff? What's the message that needs to be sent to working class farmers and rural white Americans?
Yeah, well, I so that is where the problem lies. Even when you look at New Jersey, and because I'm originally from New Jersey, so I know the dynamics of New Jersey. If you look at Southern New Jersey, you know, those are pretty rural areas, right? So I think what's happening is Carville's right in regards to reaching working class white people. And that's who I'm reaching out to in Congressional District 4, are those people. And they also feel that they're not being heard, right? Again, as we talked in the beginning about how, you know, they're working their butts off, they're struggling each and every day, but who's listening to them? Who's identifying with them? And it's the Republicans now. The Republicans are saying, look what the Democrats are doing to you. Look how they're suppressing you. And look how, you know, they're not listening to you, but we're listening to you because look, how did Youngkin win? He won because of education and jobs and the economy. And that's how, and that's basically what he talked about constantly. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where we're failing. And as I said in the beginning, we're failing in our message to working class people to be able to bring them back into the fold and say, hey, look, we are listening to you and we are working for you. And these are the things that I feel these table kitchen table issues. Why aren't we working for these issues? So yeah, we have to reach out to them, and we're not. We are having a poor message.
Is it important that the specific racial appeals be made in for politics? So you know, Jason was just talking about a moment ago, kind of efforts to reach out to Black and Latino voters, and they should be more pronounced among Democrats, but. It's in the absence of reaching out to working class voters generally seems to have to become pretty rapidly a very big liability for Democrats. And I'm not talking about white working class. I'm talking about literally working class of all ethnicities, races and creeds. I mean, you look at the results out of Virginia in particular, just because they're the most recent, a majority of Latinos in the exit polling supported Glenn Youngkin in the at the outcome there. It seems like what's happening with each passing election is the country's becoming more racially depolarized, that your race is not, is becoming less and less indicative of how you're going to vote in any given race. Should race be de-emphasized, and should sort of the nature of just helping people generally, working class people generally, be the source of emphasis?
I think the Democrats for years, and Jason may or may not agree with me, but I think what's happened is that we have identified, we have said to the African American communities, the Latino communities, we just assume they're going to vote for us. We have assumed, and so we have lost the message that we're not listening to them. We just assume they're going to go ahead. So when we go into a Black community and we're you know, campaigning and stuff like that, I don't think we're listening when we go in there. I think we're just assuming, oh, I'll just talk about the issues that, you know, affect everybody, education, healthcare, you know, we'll just talk about the issues and then, you know, make believe I'm listening to you because, hey, that's what's important to you, right? Isn't that important to you? And then leave. And then totally not acknowledge they were there, they listened, they had these concerns. And I think that's why we're losing these communities, these working class communities. We're not listening strong enough to them and doing for them. I mean, we can, you know, we talk the talk, but where's the results? You know, in Congress, where are they? Where are the results that everyone, you know, campaigned on? We're going to do this for you. We're going to do that for you.
Right.
And they're not doing it.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think what you're saying is correct. There's one of my favorite memes is, you know, I think there's like a picture where it says, you know, hey, you know, Black people, hey, can we get police reform? And then Republicans, it says no. And then for Democrats, it says no, Black Lives Matter.
You know? Right.
So it's basically the same sort of thing where Democrats do say, hey, you know, and I think the scare tactics aren't scaring people anymore. It's like, hey, you know, you vote for us because you don't want to deal with them. And they're like, but you're not giving me anything. You're not listening to me. And that's kind of, you know, how a
lot of-
We're
not bringing you to the round table either, right? So that's what I don't understand is how come when somebody goes into a community and campaigns, how come they're not sitting down with the leaders and the pastors and all the ones that are really involved in the community and having a discussion then and saying, oh, wait, you know, I had a meeting with the pastors in this community or the leaders in this community or the representatives or the council people. And this is what they said. And yes, I agree. We need to work on this and then work on it. Right. But they're not sitting down and listening. They're just campaigning, you know, and then assuming, you know, hey, the Republicans are bad guys. So, you know, you know that I'm going to work for you. But hey, I need your vote. And that's not how we.
Well, I'll tell you a quick story. And that is, and this is no disrespect to this person. I respect her 100%. Hopefully we can have her on the show at some point. Liz Warren, my wife's church, when she lived in Boston, Liz Warren came. And, you know, I was really excited because this was one time I'd gone to church with her. And so I saw, you know, Liz Warren, she was there for 5 minutes. The pastor acknowledged her and she and her husband walked out. And they probably went to 7 other churches. And that was the only time I asked her several times after that, hey, has Liz Warren come back to your church? You know, she didn't even stay to hear like the word or anything like that. So I think, you know, people get a little bit tired of that. And I don't agree with Vince that I think Black voters want to acknowledge that Black communities have issues that are specific to Black communities. So not acknowledging that is not the way to go about it. And even Donald Trump acknowledged, you know, his plan for Black America, which was nonsense, but still he acknowledged that Black communities have specific concerns.
Right.
And I think that Democrats should do that, but actually you can't just give lip service. You can't just show up when it's time to vote. You need to actually make things happen. You need to be in those communities. And we can't forget that there are rural Black people.
Right.
You know, that's the thing that I think is forgotten. Maybe not in Arizona, but certainly in a lot of states.
It's a growing community in rural Arizona. It is. It's a growing community because they can't afford Maricopa County.
Right, right.
Can you talk about the role that donors play in corrupting politics? Because I know this is a huge topic, but I one of my takeaways from this Virginia race is, you know, we saw Terry McAuliffe on September 29th. He goes on a debate stage and he says that he doesn't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach. And, you know, no matter where you fall on the specifics of the question they were debating, it was debating whether or not parents should be notified of controversial material within the classroom. That was the basis. But regardless, you get a soundbite like that, it's devastating. It showed up in the polls. Independents turned on him. Democrats, by some margin, began to turn on him. Education became one of the top issues in the entire state. And it was quite clearly to me a sop to the teachers union support that he had. He didn't want to offend the teachers union support. He was very much about making sure to protect their interests. And in the process, ended up attacking the voters and now apparently has suffered the consequences for that decision. How much do political donors distract politicians from the needs of their voters?
I don't think it's so much the donors. I think it's so much the greed in the campaign person, the person who's campaigning,
mm-hmm.
right? So I totally think that if you are a strong leader, that you're a strong person, that if somebody comes up to you and says, I'm going to give you the $2,900, but I think that, you know, you should spend more time on healthcare issue or whatever, right? I think what happens is some candidates feel, oh, well, I guess I got to have to do that, right? Because then if you have 20 donors doing the same thing, saying the same thing, because they're all in the same group, if you're not strong enough to say, hey, look, I have a gambit of issues. And so healthcare, yes, is very important, but there's mm-hmm. other issues too. And if you want me, because if you think I'm a strong leader and you think that I'll vote for the things that you feel are important, please donate to me. But we don't have that now. And especially with PACs, right? You know, with Citizens United.
Yeah.
I mean, there's people that give, you know, tens of thousands of dollars into these PACs, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so some candidates, some candidates are just not strong enough to say, hey, look, I'm here for the people that vote for me and then beyond on my vote. But they're not. It's a greed thing. I think what happens is they get greedy and then fearful that they're going to lose their if they do get elected, they're afraid that they're going to lose that position.
Now I imagine most candidates, you can tell me, you've done this before and you're doing it now. I imagine most candidates kind of they realize that it's a bit of a devil's bargain, but they convince themselves inside their head, well, these donors are only supporting in me because they believe in the principles that I'm already expressing. So I just have to convince myself of that. But that donor cash, that buying influence, the concern about who's endorsing you, that does have this impact of maybe you put a little spin on the ball. Maybe you hold back a little bit from giving your true feeling about what's actually going on. And that could be, I think, a meaningful detriment. And I realize this is a big indictment of our political system, but that could be a meaningful detriment to serving your voters well. So it's like your voters, who you should be your primary concern, and their needs are subordinated to sort of your impulses in order to succeed and to get elected.
Well, right. Vince, let me just say one place that donates to us is Grunt Style. So we have to actually give a whole lot of credit to Grunt Style. They
That's
make
right.
great t-shirts and they support veterans, which I know all three of us support our veterans. They employ hundreds of veterans and they also support veterans who have suffered from PTSD, from yep. homelessness. And so we are proud to be sponsored by Grunt Style. If you want that 10% discount, go to gruntstyle.com and enter STN, STN for Save the Nation, and you will get a 10% discount. As you guys know, I love my t-shirt that says that I love peeing outside. And I'm sure maybe even Delina and her family, being in rural Arizona, I'm sure they're no strangers to peeing outside.
They can get behind that message.
You can get that t-shirt and many others by going to gruntstyle.com. So thank you to Grunt Style. We're really appreciative their support of Save the Nation and what we do here.
I like you working in that plug. It's a good plug because they're a good company. So thank you for that.
Now, see, they're a good company, right? You know, it's not a high powered, and that's why Citizens United needs to be, you know, it has to go. It really does. We need to make sure that that's voted out, because those millions and millions of dollars that get put into PACs by these big companies. So like Grunt Style, right? They're supporting veterans. They're helping them. But then when you have, you know, these energy companies that are giving millions and millions of dollars, and these pharmaceutical companies giving millions and millions of dollars to these candidates, they put the pressure on. I worked for U.S. Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell. I know how lobbyists work in Washington, and they'll put that pressure on, and they threaten you. They'll say, hey, you know, if you don't vote for this way, you know, you may not get your money next time, you know? So again, if we could get rid of Citizens United, we wouldn't be in a lot of the problems that we're having.
Yeah, the oligarchy is kind of wrecking the whole system. It's a Faustian
bargain.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. That's why we need more young leaders too. I think young leaders are the ones that that we need to start mentoring, start bringing up through the ranks here, so that it's their future, their country. And I really think that they would be the ones also to say, hey, let's get rid of Citizens United, because I think more young people are have more empathy and more understanding of really what's going on in our country.
Yeah, I've also, you know, kind of connecting all of that with some of the things that we talked about earlier. One of the things that I think needs to happen is the Democrats need to start finding working class white candidates, honestly, and people that can reach out to that community, in addition to finding working class Black candidates. To be, they say they're the big tent party, but all of their candidates can't come from Harvard and be 70 years old. I think we need to find those people who are on the ground. And I think Vince and I agree, Terry McAuliffe was not a great candidate and did not run a really great campaign. And as you know, as many of these people, as you see the people who are holding up Build Back Better and many other things, a lot of them are beholden to special interests, particularly energy interests. And, you know, I think Joe Manchin is probably a good man, but he's also probably made, well, not even probably, I think it's a fact that he's made that Faustian bargain with coal and with other energy sources. And that's why he's chopping down Build Back Better. And Democrats are really bad at messaging.
That may be. I do think that it is worth acknowledging that he's got a percentage of his base, of course, in West Virginia, who's interested in preserving the status of the energy industry there and very concerned about meddling with that. So that would obviously play a role in this donor consideration.
But that goes to
messaging,
Vince.
Yeah. But then there's like the stuff that like, I don't know what the Progressive Caucus is doing, like, or what Democrats in Congress are doing right now. They're protecting the carried interest loophole. Like, I guess one of the things that people I don't really pay enough attention to, but probably should, is that like hedge fund managers get this special commission structure where they have to pay less taxes than anybody else who earns commission income in the United States, just because they're rich and well-connected and have a special carve out in the tax code. And nobody's for the carried interest loophole. If you tell them about it, they're like, well, wait a second. Everyone should be taxed the same on earnings that you get via a commission structure like that. But like Democrats are like preserving it. They're preserving this hedge fund loophole. And meanwhile, in the last 48 hours, we hear that they're working on passing massive tax cuts for billionaires through the SALT deduction. They want to lift the caps on the SALT deduction, meaning state and local tax deduction. And the end result is that people who are worth hundreds of millions of dollars are set to see a massive tax cut from this so-called Build Back Better program. This kind of gets to the point that I was making before, which is there's a lot of lip service paid to these issues. But when it comes down to brass tacks and it comes down to whose interests are served, even the Democrats who claim that they're trying to serve normal people, they're serving like their moneyed interests that support their party.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that that's true. Number one, it's funny how Republicans all of a sudden get interested in money and in debt and things like
that. Bernie Sanders condemned it yesterday.
$7.8 trillion of debt was added by the 2017 tax cuts. And we know that that went mostly to wealthy people. Of course, we know Bernie Sanders and others. I thought you mentioned the progressives. Bernie Sanders and others want a billionaire tax, but other people, you know.
Bernie Sanders came out yesterday, Jason, and condemned Democrats' move to cut taxes for rich people. He did.
Yeah,
he
spoke absolutely. Up about it. But the billionaire tax was something that was in Build Back Better, but Manchin and Sinema were the people who said they didn't want that because they're beholden to those interests. Mm-hmm. So I understand what you said about, you know, in terms of energy and what you're saying about Manchin. The fact that he has to be, you know, he needs those TV ads that Delina was talking about, you know, in order to win in West Virginia, which is the Trumpiest state in the country. So I get it. But at the same time, you've got to stand up for the American people. You've got to stand up for what's right. And when you go line item in Build Back Better, most Americans are with it, including taxing billionaires, which was taken out by two conservative Democrat Democratic candidates. So I think
Manchin needs to look. I understand Manchin's in an energy state, right? Coal is one of the biggest employers still to this day in that area. And energy is important. And to be honest with you, we're not going to get rid of, are you going to get rid of your computers? Are you going to get rid of your phones? Are you going to get rid of your car? And who can afford an electric car right now? So what should have been done with Manchin, and maybe it is, I know that there's always the closed door discussions that go on in Washington. Again, you know, I worked for U.S. Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell, and I understand what happens in Congress. However, maybe there should be some more incentives then for him, for his state, some kind of, again, there's always that give and take. You have to give and take. So what is it that he really needs in his state and its economy? It's always talking about the economy. And so I think that maybe there should be incentives put in for some of these energy companies to go more towards clean energy. I love when, you know, like Exxon or Mobil say, oh, we're at 8% clean energy now, or we're at 12.3% of clean energy now. And the thing is like, okay, well, can you be at 50 or 60, like by next year or something, clean energy? So it's going to take incentives of some sort. And I think Manchin should be looking at doing that and trying to push the energy companies more into clean technology. So
can I push back on one thing, Delina, though?
Sure.
So the only thing that I want to push back on is the cost of clean energy, or the cost of, you know, an electric car.
Uh-huh.
The average cost of a new car right now is $45,000. The average cost of a Model 3 Tesla is $45,000. So pretty much it is average. And as a matter of fact, you will save money by going to a charging station, which many of them are free, rather than using gasoline, which, you know, can cost families $200, you know, a month. So,
but I'm not talking about middle class. I'm talking about working class. This is where we were talking about.
Right.
How is a working class person who can't live in Maricopa County, has to live out in a rural area, how are they, and they're only getting paid $13 an hour.
Oh, yeah. No,
Or even 20, say. How are they going to be able to afford a $45,000 car, which would benefit them,
right?
Right. And so again, we have to sit down, to be honest with you, and say, okay, where do we want to put the incentives then? Are we wasting money putting incentives into energy companies to, you know, lessen their drilling and mining and all that stuff? Or should we put it in the aspect of building more electric cars and then giving incentives to the working class to be able to buy a car? So where does that balance come from? So this is why we all have to.
That comes from child tax credits. That comes from raising the minimum wage. Not, you know, I understand in Arizona you guys have a good one, but in many states they don't. Right. That comes from you know, a lot of the things that we need. You know, healthcare, people being able to afford their healthcare. Right. Those are the things that I think are in, you know, some of the legislation that Democrats are pushing, but they're just really bad at messaging it.
They are.
You know, and so, they make it all about, you know, so-called critical race theory and this and that. And
yeah, they want to spend time on that. And it's insane because it's only taught in college. You know, right. everyone in my district that I talk to are going, oh, we got to stop this critical race theory teaching in schools. And I'm like, in college? You know, right, I said, right. What, they're not being taught in schools, in public school systems. So again, the messaging. Yes, Jason.
Yeah, but really it's a catch-all for the anti-racism and the diversity, equity, inclusion sort of industry that has invaded all of these spaces. And as an end result, what they've done is they've taught race essentialism. It's just all these noxious ideas.
I guess, as I've said a million times, if you're not anti-racism, I'm not sure exactly what you are, but you know.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Anti-racism is like saying you're anti-fascist. Like you're burning down a building and be like, I'm against fascism. That's insane. Anti-racism, as it's characterized by the people who are the leading figures in it, like Ibram Kendi, is a form of prejudice. And they say it outright, Jason. And I mean, you and I can debate this story.
That's a different discussion. We don't have Ibram Kendi here. Hopefully we'll have him on the show.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to Ibram Kendi.
Let's
why I'm confused. I don't know who he is. So that's why I'm not understanding what Vince is saying.
Yeah, that's right. All right. That's all right.
That's okay. That's something we've discussed.
That was like, oh, wait, where are you going with that, Vince?
Yeah, no, that's okay if you don't know. It's corporate America keeps paying this guy like $40,000 a pop to tell everybody in the room that they're a racist. And he's making out like crazy. But anyway, this... But I'm trying to think where we were because there were so many interesting things I wanted to hit with you here. And I just got spun off in a million directions. Oh, green energy stuff. Okay, so right. let me just, I can ask both of you, but I want to ask you, Delina. Like the idea, my concern about kind of environmental political movements, especially the ones who have power right now, the Biden administration and at large, is that there's a shell game being played when it comes to environmental damage and destruction and the trade-offs that are being suffered for no gain in actual environmental improvement. So what I mean by that, I don't want to sound like Greta Thunberg or anything, but what I mean by that is that with Biden sort of shutting down new drilling and things in the United States and sort of constraining the ability of the American fossil fuel industry to grow, what we've done is we've exported fossil fuel production to countries that have much lower standards for environmental protection than we have. So now we've got Russia and China and Saudi Arabia who are producing a lot more of the energy that we actually continue to consume. It's not like our consumption needs go down. We just start bringing it in from countries that have lower environmental standards. And meanwhile, in the United States, with the blossoming of things like fracking and the ability to pull natural gas, you know, we've seen our carbon emissions go down year over year over year over these especially over the last 6 years or so, I believe. And that was a positive trend. And it was the result of sort of, you know, the American energy industry being able to more and more cleanly generate this energy. And then finally, I'll throw this in. I know there's a lot I've just said, but, you know, there's this huge reticence still to pursue what is completely clean, a zero emission technology that produces a ton of energy. That's nuclear. And it just seems like nobody wants to have a conversation about actually growing nuclear use in order to satisfy our energy needs while simultaneously meeting the expectations of people who want to bring down our carbon emissions to nothing. It seems like we've got great technology in front of us. Why don't we use it?
Well, I want to say something about nuclear, because as nuclear is a cleaner burning energy, there is so much that could happen if something goes wrong and devastating. Okay, we saw it in Russia with Chernobyl. And that area now for thousands of years can't be lived in. And then also, what about the offset of it? Okay, the nuclear waste. It's got to be stored somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're taking areas that we have to store this stuff in. And I don't think that as a human race that we need to go in that direction with nuclear power. To me, it's a dangerous future that we are creating for ourselves. When we have intelligent people today that can have clean technology, whether it be solar, wind, biofuels,
mm-hmm.
whatever it is that we can do to energize our cities. And this is why we need to have this Build Back Better, so that we have a better right. electrical grid. We have better systems in place. So I agree with you that nuclear power is clean. However, I just don't see it as a future of building all these nuclear power plants and then what the outcome may come if something goes wrong. Because I can't imagine two or three of these nuclear plants having a problem, and then we have three or four or five Chernobyls around our state or around our world. So I have to disagree with you on the nuclear power and putting a lot of effort and time and energy and money into that. But I truly think that we have the capability to be able to have the clean technology that we can to put the energy companies, keep them in business. We're always going to need energy. We're in some way or another.
Yeah.
And we need to decrease their carbon intake. And yes, I am, I'm against Paul Gosar, right? I'm running against him. He is for the energy companies. He wants to do drilling and mining in on public lands and in our national parks. He wants to do it right by or in an Indian reservation there in the Grand Canyon. Granted, I understand that we have a lot of uranium in that area, and we have other minerals and deposits that we need for these electric companies, for the engines, the components, the conductors and everything. However, I don't think we have strong enough policies to overdo the oversight of these energy companies. Because once they mess up, once they start polluting the waters, once they start polluting the land, and then our water table, our aquifers are now polluted, what's the cleanup? They go bankrupt. They go bankrupt and say goodbye. It's like the Navajo Nation back in the 1930s and 40s when they were doing all the uranium mining there. The Navajos thought, hey, this is great. You know, I'm great. They all had jobs. They were making money. And then all of the pollution and everything from these uranium mines are all, the tailings are all over the place. People today are still having cancer. Kids are having cancers. Women are having more breast cancers. But they're not doing the cleanup. Now it's up to the government to do the cleanup. Mm-hmm. And so now we're still paying for it. So we're paying for it as a government to do the cleanup of these energy companies. This is, to me, we have to have a better, I always say we have to look at the big picture.
Yes.
We can't look narrowly down something and go, well, we need this, so let's go get it. We have to look at the big picture, and then we have to communicate that message to everybody.
Right.
To say, this is how we need to do it so that it's cleaner, it's better, it's more efficient, and we're not going to make people sick and die.
Yes. Okay, go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, I just want to ask a question about, you know, the Supreme Court right now is hearing a case about the gun rights. And you're in rural Arizona, and I kind of want to get your position on the Second Amendment and on guns?
Sure. So I am a gun owner. I love shooting guns. I'm pretty good at target shooting. and I bought our first gun in New Jersey. We were, my husband and I, we just had a baby and we were robbed. And we went to Kansas and we were telling my, for a trip, and we, my father-in-law said, well, hey, let's buy a gun. So he bought a shotgun. And so then went back to New Jersey, and I knew a lot of the police officers and detectives. And they said, Delina, you know, in New Jersey, you got to register your gun. And I said, okay. So I got the FBI fingerprinting, registered the gun, not a problem, you know, got a gun. So coming here to Arizona, they carry guns in their cars and trucks. As long as you can see them, then you can get a concealed weapon license here in Arizona, where you can hide it in your purse, or you can, you know, hide it in your coat or whatever. And so the thing is I don't mind people that have guns. What I mind is the when these people come in with machine guns, just walking through Walmart, and you have young kids and mothers that are, you know, shopping, and they're, a lot of people are afraid of guns. And there's no reason for someone to have to take a machine gun into a Walmart or into a Walgreens or into a Rite Aid or to anywhere. And so I think what's happening is you get this empowerment. And Gosar here, Paul Gosar here, has empowered cities, and he pushes this for Second Amendment sanctuary cities. And what that means, and he's not just doing it here in Arizona, he's now pushing it across the nation with other people like you know, Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene and all these, to have their cities become these sanctuary, Second Amendment sanctuary cities. But what that does is it creates a militia within that city. And then they feel empowered, that they have the power to be able to go against anybody like undocumented immigrants, or, you know, say, hey, look, you know, you're not supposed to be here. So it empowers them. And even though it's not legal for them to do that, there's a lot of people, especially in rural areas, that feel that they have that empowerment. And then they come with guns. So I had a, in 2020, I went to a pride a parade and supporting the LGBTQ community there up in Kingman. And there was a large group of men who had these machine guns. And so they said, oh, well, we're protecting you just in case somebody tries something. And it's like, no, we have police officers that are also here. We don't need you here. You're intimidating people from coming to this parade, to be able to be here in this parade. Prescott, you probably saw Paul Gosar taking pictures. It's been on the national news too, where he's taking pictures with the white supremacists there, the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. They were having a protest, a Black Lives Matter protest. And these guys, and I'll say white supremacists, came to Prescott, and they're all there with their machine guns. All it is an intimidation, but it allows them, because they are a Second Amendment sanctuary city, they feel empowered to be able to do that, because they feel that that's their legal right to do that. And it's not. And so it's an intimidation process. And so that's the type of guns that we should not be having around. They don't need to be there. We have police officers to be there. We have the National Guard if they need backup. We don't need them. So a lot of, it's starting to swing, to be honest with you, here in Arizona. There are a lot of people that are moving in here, especially from Canada and California, and they don't wanna have these guns out there. We need to make sure that we have policies in place that are protecting people just going to the food store, that they're not having to be intimidated, or go to a protest and not be intimidated. And so this is why we need to have that. But that's where the gun laws come through, right? With the red flag laws, the background checks. We need to make sure those are put in place so that we don't have people who have mental issues, mental health issues, that are able to have a gun and then, you know, they're going to shoot children or they're going to shoot people. And when people, I don't know if you've ever been around these type of people, these like white supremacists that want to, you know, intimidate you. Sometimes you look at them and you're just, you know, you're like, God, he's yelling at me. He's trying to intimidate me. Is he going to go off with the gun? I mean, you shouldn't have to even think that anymore in this day and age, but we have that here, especially out West. We have that mentality here, but we need stronger policies to make sure that that's not in public.
Delina, I have a couple of clarifying questions based on what you just laid out. One, when you say machine guns, you don't mean actual fully automatic weapons,
right? AK-47, you know, automatic guns like AK-47s.
You mean you're probably referring to semi-automatic, not to fully automatic weapons.
Some of them have fully automatic weapons.
Okay, and they're carrying them around in Walmart, fully automatic.
Yeah, my husband and I were in Walmart. We're following a young woman with two children in the carriage, and we're walking through, and this guy comes with a dog who's not a service dog. He's holding the dog. He's got the AK-47 around his shoulder, and he's got a bottle of some kind of liquor. Mm-hmm. And he's looking around. I know.
What?
And so the mother, then she was heading towards where the meat is. And then he starts looking at the meat and she turns around and she goes down a couple of aisles to go get something else, I guess. And the guy is still there and he's looking and picking up the meat, putting it down, And then she comes around because we ordered some deli and he's still there. And you could see in her face how fearful she is. Mm-hmm. So crazy.
Can I clarify something? So we're saying that in these sanctuary, 2A sanctuary cities, that it allows for you to carry a fully automatic weapon?
Well, it's a fully automatic, like AK-47, you know, those kind of things that they make them automatic. But you can carry it in a store. Yeah.
Wow.
The only reason it surprises me is fully automatic weapons are one of the most highly regulated things that exist in the United States. I mean, AK-47s, they're semi-auto. And almost everybody who owns an AK-47 has a semi-auto, although it could be switched to fully auto if you owned if you had a license from the federal government to own a fully automatic weapon.
Anyway. Even if you have a license, you shouldn't be walking around with alcohol and an AK-47 like that. You know, those things don't mix. This is why even in Florida, you can't walk into a bar with your weapon, whether it's concealed or open carry. You can't do that.
It's a bad recipe. So you also mentioned that there are some meaningful white supremacist groups in Western Arizona.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about that.
So we have in the Prescott area, there's the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys. Gotcha. I know you heard of them through, you know, national TV.
Yes.
So these groups are, and it's not just here in Arizona. I mean, they're all over the country.
I wanted to ask about that because I heard you say those groups. I was wondering if you refer to them as white supremacists. Now, I don't know, maybe there are meaningful white supremacists in them, but the Oath Keepers group is a militia group, right? And I think the Proud Boys, they're kind of like, they're really like a hooligan group. I know that they've got, their leader is like a black Puerto Rican guy. Cuban guy. Okay. But you consider those groups white supremacists, probably based on something you've learned in Arizona there about them.
Yeah. I mean, they're the ones that are coming to these Black Lives Matter and in protest meetings and intimidating the people that are there, that they shouldn't be there supporting Black Lives Matter, because they're saying, White Lives Matter. They'll have signs that say White Lives Matter or All Lives Matter. You shouldn't be here. Get out of our city, get out of our state, you know, those kind of things. And they're, you know, they're the ones that are pushing the malicious side of it. And that's what to me is very dangerous.
Do you guys still have those, like, you know, I remember being as a, you know, maybe a couple of years ago, I think it was maybe a decade ago. There was the killing of a young girl named Brisenia Flores, and her father, I think her father's name was Raul. And then she was killed on the border by, and turns out that she was an American citizen, but she was killed by militia men. I can't remember what they called themselves, but they-
Minutemen.
Minutemen, exactly. Is that still an issue in Arizona? Do you still have Minutemen, or, you know, maybe they've rebranded, but are those kinds of groups still around?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. When you go down to the border, especially through more of the rural areas that are kind of open, there's Minutemen there. There's men that go every weekend, you know, because they all get together as a group and they all go, and they're protecting the border. You know, and I don't, you know, you hear stories through, you know, some of the media around here and some of the, you know, groups of human rights groups that are around, that they're there, and there's probably bodies in Arizona, you know, in these areas that have been undocumented immigrants who've come over and they've killed them. So I don't know about that. I don't know that for sure. I mean, once in a while you'll hear a little story about, you know, somebody was shot and must have been there for over a year or whatever. However, and you don't know who it is for sure, but these Minutemen still go down there, and they still, like a little militia group, kind of protect our border. And we don't know what they do. You know, we don't have any clue what they're doing down there, if they even have, you know, confront anybody down there.
Yeah, it's another, I take it as another sign, like the border needs to be secure so we don't have to rely on private citizens to have to try and take up the job.
I don't think we have to rely on them. I don't think anybody's relying on them. I think they take it upon themselves. They're vigilantes.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a need that, like, in other words, like there, you have a massive number of people illegally crossing, as we've all acknowledged. There will be people who realize, who think to themselves, well, if no one else is going to do it, I'll go do it. And so if you want to avoid that circumstance, then you need to have an effective border.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. You need more border patrol people that are paid better, have more the resources that they need, and policies in place so that, so that we're doing everything legally and not what they're doing or whatever they're doing.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. That, I mean, that to me, what you're laying out there, Vince, is the George Zimmerman mentality. Like, there's crime, so I got to be Batman, and that's a recipe for disaster. That's a recipe for taking other people's rights away. That's a really dangerous thing.
It's a sociological point, though. It's like it's a social science point. In other words, if, like, you ignore a problem long enough, whatever that problem is, eventually people are going to take radical steps to address it. And so you don't want that. If you're trying to avoid that, you have to be you have to have responsive governance, where you actually, you know, make sure you keep crime down in the community, or you keep the border secure, sort of the obvious things that you expect from your government.
Yeah, but a lot of that is people being whipped up. I don't think that there was necessarily, now again, I'm making a different point here from the border, but when we're looking at, and we also know that undocumented people actually commit fewer crimes than native born.
We don't know that. We don't know that.
We do know that. We do.
No, we don't. We know that immigrants.
We absolutely know that.
Wait a sec.
Let me finish my point.
We know that immigrants commit fewer.
I was in the middle of speaking.
We know that immigrants commit fewer crimes than native born Americans.
Absolutely.
That's true. But this idea that we have a carve out for illegals, we don't even know how many illegals are in the country.
Right. That's true. But we do know from all of the studies that have been done, undocumented people, because they want to stay out under the radar, commit fewer crimes. That's just a fact, you know. But anyway, if we're going to go by what law enforcement and the, you know, what law enforcement finds, somehow if undocumented people are able to escape crime, responsibility for crime in a way, you know, that the rest of Americans are, maybe that's an indictment of law enforcement in America. I don't know. But apparently, based on the statistics that we that are available, undocumented people commit fewer crimes than native-born Americans. Now, having said that, I believe in law enforcement. I do believe that law enforcement should be paid better. I do believe that law enforcement should be trusted to handle these issues. And when you get the George Zimmermans of the world, you get those results, which are terrible for everybody. So, you know, hopefully Americans will, you know, fix some of these problems. And with George Zimmerman, there wasn't really a crime issue in that area. He just decided he wanted to be a vigilante. And I think that that's a dangerous, dangerous thing for all of us. But one thing that is not dangerous is Delina DeSanto. And I think that she's been very gracious with her time. We're really thankful to have her on the show. And we're definitely going to have you back. Best of luck with your election coming soon. Also, want to say that our show is brought to you by GoldCo, and that you can find us on all podcast platforms, on YouTube and on Facebook Watch, and on the Daily Caller website. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. Vince, it's always great. You know, you're my brother. Delina, thank you so much for everything.
Sure. Thank you, Jason and Vince, for having me. I really enjoyed it. I could have kept on going with. There's so many other issues that we could.
Yeah, we could solve all the world's problems.
Yeah, really, just the three of us. Hey, you know,
we should. Absolutely.